From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, athletes from across the globe are chasing glory in Sochi, at the same time Russian authorities crack down on gay rights activists.
They want it to be known. They want LGBT people to be scared.
A Kansas town nearly destroyed by tornadoes goes green to rebuild.
Our grandparents and our parents always taught us, if you take care of the land, it will take care of you.
And we talk with a Los Angeles icon who's been on the air since the golden age of radio.
Well, my name is Art LeBeau, and I'm on the radio. Been on for 70 years.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Unless you've been under a rock, you know the Winter Olympics are here. Vladimir Putin's government has committed massive resources to make this a shining moment for modern Russia. But for months, unwelcome stories have loomed in the background, casting Russia in a very unmodern light. Life is still dangerous for political dissidents, and a crackdown on gay rights has triggered outrage across the world.
We must all raise our voices against attacks on lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgender, or intersex people.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking on Thursday. Vladimir Putin has been trying to project a kinder face recently. Some prominent dissidents were released from prison, and Putin has cast the anti-gay propaganda law in a softer light, saying it was merely about protecting kids. But yesterday, just a day after Ban Ki-moon's remarks, the day of the opening ceremonies, activists say more than a dozen gay rights demonstrators were arrested. That brings us to our cover story today. When it comes to human rights and tolerating dissent, is Russia moving forward or backwards? Russia began enforcing its law banning so-called gay propaganda last summer. The law is vague, but it makes it illegal to disseminate information on non-traditional sexual relations to minors. We reached out to Svetlana Zakharova. She's an activist with the Russian LGBT network in St. Petersburg. She says the law has deeply affected LGBT Russians.
I believe that LGBT people feel more depressed, more vulnerable, and they don't really see their future because of that.
And has it changed how people are just going about their lives day to day? I mean, is a same-sex couple comfortable holding hands in public or things like that?
Well, in fact, I think that there were not that many people who were doing it before.
Mm-hmm.
But now, for LGBT people, definitely the situation is much worse because they feel much more targeted now. Because there are public debates about them. And on the other hand, LGBT community got quite big level of support as never before. Mm. But at the same time, there are much more open expressions of aggression. So it's double-sided.
And have there been more incidents of violence or attacks?
Well, there were always attacks, but now they're demonstrative.
How do you mean?
I mean that people who are attacking, they want it to be known. They want LGBT people to be scared.
Svetlana, why do you think these laws were passed in the first place?
I believe that there are really a lot of social, economic problems in Russia, and that's how the authorities are trying to challenge public discontent. They are trying to disattract attention from real problems, and they want to blame somebody. And LGBT community became the target.
That was Svetlana Zakharova. She's with the Russian LGBT network in St. Petersburg. The public discontent that she's talking about hit a boiling point in 2012 in a wave of pro-democracy, anti-Putin protests. Julia Yaffe is a senior editor for The New Republic. She covered those protests, and she agrees the Russian government's crackdown on gay rights was, in part, a response to that movement.
One of the ways you crack down was by fostering this traditionalist, conservative, patriarchal image. You know, I think what Americans and Westerners hear about is the anti-gay laws, but there were a bunch of other laws of the same vein and were just designed as kind of signaling tools of that, like, this is the way Russia's going now. For example, There was a law proposed that would ban Russians from getting married more than four times. There was a law that did pass that criminalizes offending the feelings of religious believers. So this is just part of this kind of traditionalist image that Putin has been pushing for the last year or two.
So you talked about how this issue of gay rights is set against this larger political conflict in Russia. Where is the anti-Putin movement? Where does it stand today?
It's splintered. It's been deprived of some of its main symbols now that Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the jailed oil tycoon, has been released from prison, now that Pussy Riot has been released from prison. That said, a lot of the strength of the street protests has been sublimated into this kind of quieter civic activism or people starting volunteer organizations. It's this effort to hold on to what was a main staple of the protests, which was the dispelling of this notion that you're alone, that you're the only one who disagrees with the regime and that you're by yourself. During the protests, people realized that was not the case, and there were many, many, many of them. People are still very dissatisfied, but they're not ready to go out into the streets anymore because they went to one protest, two protests, 10 protests, and nothing changed. And I think they're channeling their energies into these online or offline civic groups to kind of do something with their frustration.
In your piece, you write about how, in spite of what this really seems like, Putin has really conquered his enemies. You write that he's crushed his opposition but has nothing to show for it but a country that's falling apart.
Political change in Russia has come in the last, 100 years, has come because of long-standing economic malaise and trouble. And we're starting to see the beginning of that in Russia. The money's running out because the Russian state and its populist budget has become so bloated that it needs much higher oil prices to be able to sustain itself. And if oil prices aren't growing, the Russian economy isn't growing. You know, but at such obscene levels of corruption, people are running out of money to steal. And that also creates room for a lot of potential conflict among the economic elites, which, in the past has been disastrous for Russia.
That was Julia Yaffe. We reached her in Moscow. Her story is in the latest issue of The New Republic. Meanwhile, in Sochi, the games continue. Today, the U.S. won its first gold for slope-style snowboarding. It's a new event this year, and it's not the only one. On Tuesday, the sport of women's ski jumping makes its Winter Olympics debut. One of the athletes competing will be 29-year-old Lindsay Van from Park City, Utah. As part of our series, The Edge, NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
When she was a tiny girl, amazing people with her ability to fearlessly fly through the air, ski jumper Lindsay Van had a dream.
My goal is to make the Olympic team 2002 for girls.
This clip comes from a documentary called Ready to Fly that chronicles Van's fight to get to the games. For Van, working hard to be the very best in her sport wasn't enough because women ski jumpers weren't welcome in the Olympics until this year. 12 years after the games Van first set her sights on.
For the first time ever, we are thrilled to be naming both men and women to our U.S. Olympic ski jumping team.
Luke Bodensteiner is executive vice president of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. The announcement was broadcast by teleconference.
From Park City, Utah, Lindsay Van.
For Van, this marks the end of a very long road. In Sochi earlier this week, she said she was excited her sport was finally getting its due.
It's taken 90 years for women to be here, so hey, check us out. I mean, I'm just thrilled to show ski jumping to the world and that women can do it too.
At what was the most intense part of the battle, Van was one of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the organizing committee for the Vancouver Olympics. The goal was to force them to let women compete, but the legal effort failed.
Just pretty painful to watch, people I grew up training with be able to have the opportunity and me sit there knowing that I don't even have that opportunity because I'm not a male.
Olympic officials and others argued that women's ski jumping wasn't advanced enough as a sport. Not enough women competed worldwide and not at a high enough level. In a 2005 interview with NPR, Gianfranco Casper, who is head of the International Ski Federation, said he wasn't convinced women's bodies were cut out for the sport.
Don't forget, it's like jumping down from, let's say, about 2 meters on the ground about 1,000 times a year, which seemed not to be appropriate for ladies from a medical point of view.
Times have changed, and in 2011, after years of fighting, Van and the world's other female ski jumpers got the news they had been waiting for. The International Olympic Committee announced that women's ski jumping would make its debut at the Sochi Games. Then began a new kind of struggle, actually making the team. A near-record crowd came out to watch the trials in Park City, Utah in December, and Van said she was soaking it all in.
I try not to think about the historic nature of it today, you know, try to focus on my jumps and not put too much pressure on myself.
Over the years, representing her sport has taken a toll on Van.
She's a great and talented athlete who loves to fly, and all the rest is just stuff she has to endure.
Bill Carrig is the filmmaker behind Ready to Fly, and he was there in Park City to cheer her on.
I know she lost so much sleep over it, and her athletic performance suffered, just ulcers, and it was a really tough go on her.
Van came in second at the trials and had to wait another 3 weeks to find out whether she made the team. But she said she was glad to finally just focus on the competition rather than the fight to compete.
It's great to be an athlete and, you know, finally have that focus and be a real athlete, you know, get those same opportunities, and we're all excited to be here.
At the press conference announcing the Olympic team, the athletes were asked about their medal chances here in Sochi. Their coach jumped in and said, all these women deserve a medal for what they've done for the sport. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Sochi.
Now a conversation with one of our most celebrated poets. Marilyn Nelson is a rare double threat as a poet, equally adept at writing for adults and children. And she has a gift for confronting difficult subjects. Her book, A Wreath for Emmett Till, is a meditation on a historic lynching in poetry that could be appreciated by anyone from the age of 12 on up. Her latest collection is a memoir about her own childhood, a series of 50 poems about growing up, traveling all over America, following her father's assignments for the Air Force.
He graduated in the last class of cadets from the flight school at Tuskegee. So they're now the Tuskegee Airmen. So the story I tell is of the family of an African-American flying officer.
And because of that, you know, and this is reflected in these poems, as you travel, as a military family does, often across the country, you're frequently the first black family, you know, in a lot of these places. You're the first black kid in a lot of these schools, right?
Right, yes. Back when I was in college, people used to talk about the alienation of the artist, not ever quite fitting in any place.
Could I have you read one of the poems that, I, for me, definitely conveys some of that?
Yes.
Could you read A Snake?
Okay. This is A Snake. Each of the poems is identified with a place and a date. So this is Lowry Air Force Base, Colorado, 1953. As soon as we got here, we turned around and drove back through the no guardrail mountains, connecting the dots of farm mailboxes to towns and faceless people who don't count. Mama hugged Aunt Karma and Uncle George. Daddy wiped his tears with his handkerchief. Onita wasn't in her pink bedroom. She wasn't in the hospital either. They said she was in that box. She was dead. We drove back through the frightening mountains. Jennifer and I chanted, "There's a snake!" to keep ourselves from looking at the huge and scare-defying emptiness. When you die, you go to a different school.
There's kind of a lot in that from this perspective. You know, even death is seen through the lens of just this another stage of dislocation.
Right, right. And for me, for much of my life, when we moved, we just thought the world behind us disappeared and all of the people, they just didn't exist anymore.
I got to ask you to read another poem. If you could read Parking Lot Dawn.
Parking Lot Dawn, On the Road, 1959, one of my favorite memories. After the cousins came the long drive west, car games, sing-alongs, and conversation, alternating drivers, meals in the car. Gas station restrooms or behind a tree. Daddy corrects white men who call him boy, even when they're in police uniforms, even though the radio updates news of sit-ins and white citizens' councils. I ride behind his beautiful close-cropped head, my window slightly cracked for Spida's nose. Last night, awake alone, he parked the car in the Grand Canyon visitors' parking lot, and this morning he woke us up to dawn. There's more beauty on earth than I can bear.
Above that.
My father was so proud. I don't know, he wasn't one of those famous Tuskegee Airmen, but I imagine all of them were like this. We would be driving down the highway and get stopped because my father was speeding. I've written another poem about this incident. And a cop stopped us and said, "What do you think you're flying, boy?" And my father said, "B-52s." So there's that attitude in this poem, too, which I think of as a Tuskegee Airman attitude.
And the beautiful point that the poetry works towards in this kind of broader narrative over the course of the 50 poems is you're becoming self-aware as a poet and awareness of poetry in that language. Could you read the title poem?
Yes. In some ways, this is the seed poem for this book. I wrote this poem many years ago. It's probably 20 years old. And for some reason, it's the only poem in this earlier book that's written as an unrhymed sonnet. And then the rest of the book kind of grew around this poem. So there, this is How I Discovered Poetry, Clinton Sherman Air Force Base, Oklahoma, 1959. It was like soul kissing, the way the words filled my mouth as Mrs. Purdy read from her desk. All the other kids zoned an hour ahead to 3:15, but Mrs. Purdy and I wandered lonely as clouds borne by a breeze off Mount Parnassus. She must have seen the darkest eyes in the room brim. The next day, she gave me a poem she'd chosen especially for me to read to the all-except-for-me white class. She smiled when she told me to read it, smiled harder, said, "Oh, yes, I could." She smiled harder and harder until I stood and opened my mouth to banjo-playing darkies, pickaninnies, disses, and dats. When I finished, my classmates stared at the floor. We walked silent to the buses, awed by the power of words.
Marilyn Nelson, reading the title poem of her memoir, How I Discovered Poetry. You can read an excerpt of her book at our website, npr.org. Marilyn Nelson, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
If you get to the movies regularly, you might know the music of our next guest. Alexandra Desplat has scored dozens of films across an astonishing range of styles and genres. Zero Dark Thirty, The King's Speech, Harry Potter, and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Desplat has been nominated for 6 Academy Awards, and he's up for an Oscar again, this time for Philomena. The film tells the true story of a woman named Philomena Lee. In the 1950s, Lee was a naive Irish teenager who knew nothing about sex and got pregnant. She gave birth in a convent where the nuns forced her to sign away her parental rights. Her son was kept in a home at the convent, and Lee was able to visit him once a day. But when the boy was three, the nuns sold him for adoption in America.
Anthony! Anthony!
5 decades later, Philomena Lee, played by Judy Dench, goes looking for her son, and she has the help of a journalist, played by Steve Coogan.
They said that you had abandoned him as a baby.
She's been looking for him. She spent her whole life trying to find him.
I did not abandon my child.
I recently spoke with Alexandre Desplat about how he wrote the music for Philomena. He told me that the starting point for his score was always the main character.
It's about her and the pain and the loss and this journey through life without her son. But it all goes back to the original scene in which she meets a boy that she will make love with.
This is where the young Philomena meets the young man at the fair.
Yes, yes, and you hear in the background a carousel playing.
I like her dress. Did you make it yourself?
No, I bought it in a shop. And anyways, my aunt told me I wasn't supposed to speak to strange men like you.
That's where you hear that melody for the first time. Subliminally, nobody, I hope, notices it, but there's a melody playing there, and that's the melody you're gonna hear again and again through the film, like this ghost haunting her. There's a ghost in the film, and it's her boy who has disappeared.
So we feel the character of this woman so strongly in this music and in this theme, but of course so much of the marvelous dramatic tension in the film is how utterly different she is from the other main character. This is the Steve Coogan, the journalist character. How did you sort of mix their sensibilities musically?
Well, the great talent of Stephen Frears, all through the film, and of course of the writers, Jeff Pope and Steve Coogan, was to balance drama, a very tragic drama, and comedy. Music can't become too tragic or too dramatic, otherwise it just makes the boat tilt to the wrong side. You know, if you tilt too much gravitas, then you kill the comedy. If the music is too comedic, it kills the gravitas. It seems easy when you watch a film like this. You think, oh, that's an easy film to score because the music is intimate, there's not a big orchestra. But it's actually, I think, one of the most difficult things to do.
How did you work with the director, with Stephen Frears, in terms of figuring out that balance?
Well, you know, Stephen is already an old companion because it's our fourth movie together,
right,
since The Queen. He has an incredible sense of humor, and also when he chooses a collaborator, he trusts him. Great directors, they have this talent of picking up people for the crew which they can trust, and then they just guide them gently as you guide a fast car. You know, they know that you can go somewhere very fast and very well. And if you get a bit off the track, they just bring you back to the track, which is exactly what Stephen does.
You know, I don't know, this just sounds smug in a way, but I was impressed with the Academy for nominating this film. Again, because the music is subtle. It's not this music that screams out and is going with like flags waving and bells whistling. And it seems as though the music, along with the film, obviously, has really landed with people emotionally.
The music being recognized by the Academy is, yes, a great deal for me, because through the years, I can see that most of the films that get attention are the films where the music is loud, you know, where there's a lot of music and it's crying loud. Sometimes a sparse score is more difficult to do, much more difficult than it seems.
That's composer Alexandre Desplat. He wrote the Oscar-nominated music for the film Philomena, and he joined us here in the studio. Alexandre, thank you so much.
Thank you for hosting me. Thank you.
On Capitol Hill this week, another congressman is calling it quits. Representative Rob Andrews, a Democrat from New Jersey, will be resigning a week from Tuesday. In his 23 years in Congress, Andrews proposed 646 bills, and none of them was ever enacted. The Washington Post called it the, quote, worst record of the last 20 years. I spoke with Andrews earlier this week and asked him to respond to that headline.
The way bills are passed here is that you put an idea out there, and then you get it into a larger piece of moving legislation, like the defense bill or the health care bill. And the gross inaccuracy in that article is that I think we've managed to pass close to 200 pieces of legislation last 5 or 6 years that way. Those who used to watch Schoolhouse Rock, I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. That's not the way it ever works, that freestanding bills essentially never get enacted.
Obviously, there's a lot of cynicism about Washington these days, and it's kind of hard for people to get a sense of how things work clearly in Washington and how their laws are made.
I think it's because people are not focused on process. They are rightfully focused on outcomes, on results. Here's the things that have changed. If you're 25 and your parents have health insurance, you can stay on their policy. If you had skin cancer when you're 35, you can't be denied a health insurance policy now because you had skin cancer. People are not interested in process. They're interested in the effect that laws have on their lives and how those laws could be made better. So it's kind of a parlor game in Washington of watching process. But the other 99.9% of people in the country are very interested in the result that process has on them. That's what I have focused on here.
And does that come across for people, that they have a sense of, you know, like you as your individual congressman can get things done for them?
I kind of think it does. I mean, I'm very humbled by the fact that the last time I stood for election in 2012, I received the highest number of votes of any congressional candidate in the history of the state of New Jersey for the House of Representatives. And so I think those 205,000 people, whatever it was, kind of answered that question. I'm very grateful to them.
The House opened an ethics investigation over a year ago looking into misuse of campaign money to fund personal travel. Did that have anything to do with your resignation?
Not at all. My decision was based upon the fact that the chance to join a very prominent law firm that's run by people that I have looked at as friends and mentors for a long time offered me a chance to do work that I love in a way that would help my family become more stable, be able to educate my kids. And I, you know, willingly took the opportunity. That was why I made this decision.
Finally, there are a number of retirements this year, and you're the eighth of the House Democrats to announce plans to leave office this year. What do you think about the elections this year that are coming up?
I think the Republicans are going to have a very difficult time explaining why the obstructed policies of the president helped create 7 million jobs. They're going to have a hard time explaining why on nearly 50 occasions they tried to repeal a health care bill that's gotten 9 million people health insurance. They're going to have a hard time explaining why after the Senate overwhelmingly passed a necessary immigration reform bill, they won't even put it up for a vote. They're going to have a hard time explaining why, as millions of Americans have had their unemployment benefits expire, they won't even put that up for a vote. I don't envy them for that position. I think it gives us a significant advantage in the midterm election.
That's Representative Rob Andrews of New Jersey. His last day in office is February 18th. And now for something a little different. Hari Kondabolu is a writer and comedian. You might have caught his commentaries on the show Totally Biased. Hari says some things in the news have been bugging him lately, starting with the Olympics. A lot of Indian Americans, like myself, were sad to see India officially excluded from the Games, thanks to a dispute with the International Olympic Committee. Hari, though, will still be rooting for the three Indian athletes who are there. They're just competing under the Olympic flag.
There's something nice about seeing
someone with your skin tone or features do well. When Jeremy Lin was dominating in basketball, you know, when he was a Knick, when he just started, you know, I was all about that, you know, because that was the closest we'd ever gotten, even though he's like Taiwanese American. That was close enough. Because I knew people growing up, Indian kids were great basketball players, but then they went to pharmacy school. Sports shouldn't matter. And at the same time, there is a pride in like, we got one. Like there are these two brothers from Canada, the Bullard brothers. And they're like, there's 7 feet Indian brothers. And I want them to make the NBA and dominate in sports, even though they're incredibly slow. And they seem to struggle at dunking, even though they're like 9 feet tall. I don't even care if they don't start. I just want them to wear a uniform. It could be a Bobcats uniform. It really doesn't matter.
Keeping on with sports, a little bit of a controversy over the commercial that premiered last week on the Super Bowl. This is the Coke commercial.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies.
Por tus olas de grano sombar.
Sounds very controversial, Arun.
What was it that upset people about America the Beautiful in so many different languages?
People got upset that it wasn't, according to Twitter, that it wasn't in our national language, American, which is not our national language. And apparently they thought it was disrespectful that the national anthem wasn't being spoken in American. It's not our national anthem. And even if it were, it's kind of a bizarre thing when you have all these different people that make up the United States and people are freaking out about it because it's not a white person singing America the Beautiful in English. It's kind of an absurd thing. So there were these hashtags on Twitter that said boycott Coke. And that put me in an uncomfortable position because I had to defend Coke, even though generally if you said boycott Coke, I'd probably be on board, as would so many people who've been campaigning in Colombia and India and wherever Coke has done harm. That's how evil racism is, where I have to defend the Coca-Cola Corporation.
So let's cap this off with some real news. This is something you noticed this week. These are the confirmation hearings for Vivek Murthy, who I believe is going to be the first Indian-American Surgeon General, assuming he gets confirmed. This is Pat Roberts from Kansas connecting with Vivek.
You ever been to Dodge City, Kansas?
I have not, sir, but I would love to come.
Well, good. I'm going to invite you. Yeah, because we have a wonderful doctor from India. She is highly respected by the community. And another doctor from India that did my carpal tunnel. And so I think you'd be right at home, and we would welcome you.
I should point out for listeners as well that there were actual uncomfortable giggling in the background
right
when he was actually saying that.
Pat Roberts from Kansas did not understand that at all. First of all, Vivek Murthy, if you're listening to this, do not go to Dodge City, Kansas. You don't need to get the hell out of Dodge if you never go to Dodge. There is something funny about, like, he's an Indian-American doctor who's finally going to be Surgeon General. So there is something about, like, that's a stereotype, an Indian-American doctor. And I have to support the stereotype once again because of racism. He couldn't filibuster, right? But part of me is like, are you trying to filibuster by listing every Indian-American you know? And unfortunately, you only know two? Is that what happened? It reminded me of stories that my father told me when he first came to this country and went to a small town in Louisiana. A woman once came up to him, it was an older woman, and said, excuse me, sir, are you Chinese? This was back in like the 70s. And they would say, do you know Dr. Rao, who was an Indian doctor in town? And of course my father did, because you know, there was only two. But, like, there is something strange about 2014. Pat Roberts is a senator. Honestly, I wish Vivek Murthy said, I know a few Pats. Do you know them?
That's Hari Kondabolu. He's a writer and comedian, and he speaks for himself. We love you, Dodge City. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
The debate is settled. Climate change is a fact. And when our children's children look us in the eye and ask if we did all we could to leave them a safer, more stable world with new sources of energy, I want us to be able to say, yes, we did.
President Obama from the State of the Union address. Of course, in politics, and it seems especially when it comes to climate change, talk is cheap. Climate change, or global warming as we used to call it, has been part of our national discussion for over 20 years. But with today's political polarization and divided government, it seems harder than ever for the government to actually do anything. That's our cover story today. With the president and Congress at odds over how to address climate change, where does that leave the American people? The president has made it clear that he intends to set strict limits on power plant emissions through the Environmental Protection Agency. Republicans in Congress have made it clear that they want to find a way to stop that. But NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley says the president is already moving forward with another part of his plan without help from Congress.
The president's plan is partly about reducing changes to the Earth's climate, mainly by cutting back on greenhouse gases, but it's also about adapting to those changes we can't stop, and that means getting more resilient to floods or droughts or wildfires or invasive insects, all the sort of biblical plagues that come along with climate change. And this week, his agriculture secretary announced the creation of 7 climate hubs around the country. These will be national research centers that will focus on helping farmers and ranchers and others in rural communities to cope with climate change.
Of course, we've heard Republicans are not on board with most of the president's plan, most notably his intention to impose stricter regulations on power plant emissions. So are we headed toward a political showdown on this issue?
Well, it doesn't look as if Congress itself is going to tackle climate change. So one of the big tools in the president's toolbox now is the EPA, and that agency has been working on rules that would limit carbon pollution from power plants, especially coal-fired plants. They're responsible for about 40% of the greenhouse gases in this country. So there will be a fight over those rules, which the president wants to see finalized next year. The EPA is acting under the Clean Air Act, so it doesn't take affirmative action by the Congress to authorize this, but the critics in Congress will try to challenge that. Perhaps more importantly, the EPA authority is being challenged in the Supreme Court, and the High Court set to hear arguments later this month.
NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure.
One of the congressmen leading the fight against regulating power plants is Ed Whitfield, Republican representative from Kentucky. He says just because climate change is real shouldn't mean the government can hit power companies with overly strict regulations.
We have legislation that's been reported out of the Energy and Commerce Committee that basically says to EPA, when you set the emission standards, you have to set a standard that has been adequately demonstrated in the marketplace.
His proposal would prevent the EPA from setting drastically lower emission standards for coal-fired power plants. He says the president's plan to limit carbon emissions is rash and will hurt the economy.
He is moving quickly to transform the way electricity can be produced in America at a time when we do not have enough renewable power to come close to meeting the requirements.
That's Congressman Ed Whitfield of Kentucky. In Washington, the debate over what to do about climate change is split largely down party lines, but it hasn't always been that way. Senator John McCain actually campaigned on the issue in his presidential runs. Here he is in 2007.
Climate change is real. The Earth is warming, and it is a result of greenhouse gas emissions.
Climate change was on the country's mind that spring because deadly storms were ripping through the Midwest.
Tornado emergency.
A large and dangerous tornado by the National Weather
Service. The worst tornado came on the night of May 4th, 2007. It was the most intense storm of a season that itself was the worst in 50 years.
A tornado emergency now in effect for Greensburg in Kiowa County.
Oh, tornado to the east! Huge tornado! Look at that!
Bob Dixon is a longtime resident of Greensburg, Kansas. He remembers that night vividly.
On May the 4th of 2007 at 9:40 at night, we lost everything, my wife and I, as did everyone in town. Our home was sucked off the top of the foundation, and there was no walls, there was no floor. We were in the basement, and it just took everything. What we had left was the clothes we had on our back. It's those little intrinsic things that you lose, like family recipes, like heirlooms.
11 people died, and 95% of the town was destroyed. In the aftermath of the storm, some people said the town itself was one of the casualties. Bob Dixon didn't think so. He ran for mayor, promising to rebuild the town. Now, Dixon is a Republican, but his approach? Attack climate change head on. His plan? Rebuild Greensburg green to make it a safe, sustainable city. He won the election in a landslide. Now, halfway through his second term, Dixon has delivered. Greensburg has a new hospital and a new school built using sustainable architecture. There are wind turbines and solar panels all over town.
Well, right off the bat, and I'm going to be very candid with you and especially with me, whenever I heard the term green, all I could think of was the liberal left-wing New Age movement that we in rural America felt was just not appropriate. But when we drilled down closer to it and looked at everything, we realized that our heritage and our ancestors was based on those sustainable green principles. Our grandparents and our parents always taught us, if you take care of the land, it will take care of you.
People obviously would want to know, looking at Greensburg, why you've been able to have this be less of a partisan debate. Is it as simple as the fact that you've experienced that extreme weather that was so devastating?
Well, it banded us together. You can build the greenest community in the world. You can eliminate as much carbon emissions as you want. But if you don't have the people to inhabit that community and a vibrant economy that they can live and work and feed their families, you're not a sustainable community.
Do you feel like these policies put you at odds with national Republicans, with, say, Republicans in Congress?
We perceive certain things when we hear Republican or Democrat, preconceived ideas of what Republicans and Democrats think on issues, when in fact it should come down to what do we as citizens think about these issues, not what we're being told, but what we've investigated and how they can be implemented at the lowest level possible, which is our local level. It's about us as a society surviving and the ability to endure, and that's what true sustainability is.
Bob Dixon is the Republican mayor of Greensburg, Kansas. He's also one of the local leaders on the president's task force for climate preparedness. The UN panel on climate change warns storms will continue to get more severe and more frequent. Mayor Dixon is hoping Greensburg's approach can be instructive to other communities across the country as they brace for more extreme weather. It's been a rainy weekend here in California, but unless you're a tourist, that's a good thing. California has been locked in the grip of a historic drought. Farmers may be suffering, but as NPR's Nathan Rott reports, others are finding an opportunity.
Wayne Warren shakes wet dirt out of a plastic bucket and into a metal chute, tossing aside the bigger rocks. He's all smiles because for him, California's drought is...
golden.
Yes, golden. Warren is knee-deep in the San Gabriel River, an hour outside of Los Angeles. That chute next to him is a sluice box. The water washes away the dirt in a muddy cloud, and he leans over the box.
I don't know if you can see all that yellow in there.
Oh, yeah. Out of the creek, he taps his findings into a green plastic gold pan and gives it a few swirls. What's left...
sure is pretty in the sun, though.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Guess that's why they call it gold, huh?
Yeah.
Consider this the golden lining of California's historic drought.
Yeah, it's good for the gold prospectors. They love it because they can get down to that bedrock without using any scuba equipment.
This is Kurt Timmons, another gold prospector and the owner of a mining supply shop just down the mountain. He's been walking the riverbanks of the San Gabriel his whole life.
Normally, it'd be 6 feet over your head. And now it's so low, it'd probably be up to your knees in depth, if that.
Little rain and even less snowpack have made the San Gabriel River more of a stream. And it's not just here. Kevin Hoagland is with the Gold Prospectors Association of America.
And it's beyond just the state of California. Where I'm at in Arizona, we haven't even had our first snow yet.
He says that's opened up riverbeds there, too.
It's given people an opportunity to literally just go in with a gold pan and a shovel and be able to get in some of these cracks and crevices and find gold that you wouldn't normally be able to recover.
Hoagland says it's not 1849 again. No need to pack the wagon and head west. But it is exciting for most people. Not Maury Roos. He's the chief hydrologist at California's Department of Water Resources.
Well, it's a bad thing for those who need water, and I imagine it's not the best thing either for the fish that live in the rivers.
Ruth says it's a good thing some people are benefiting, but overall, this drought is bad. Many of California's rivers are at or near record low water volumes, and even with rain, their outlook isn't good. He says that will affect fisheries, already endangered salmon, watersheds.
It would even affect the trees and the vegetation.
And that's not to mention the people, the cities that are under mandatory water restrictions, or the farmers who let their lands go fallow or unplanted. For a clearer picture, just go back to where our guys were looking for gold on the San Gabriel River. Follow it south to where it pools behind the San Gabriel Dam, and you'll see high water lines some 100 feet above the reservoir's surface. The three major dams in this canyon hold nearly 40,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of water. According to the Los Angeles County Public Works, less than 1% is available for release. That doesn't quite have that same golden glimmer. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. And on this day, 50 years ago, oh, you know what happened.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
For three straight Sundays, the Beatles entertained America on The Ed Sullivan Show. And even though a few acts from the UK had already started their assault on our shores, this is now considered the unofficial beginning of the British invasion. Rolling Stones, The Kinks, The Who, Herman's Hermits, they all sold millions here. But for whatever reason, a few great British bands from that era did not make the trip across the pond. We have just the person to fill in those gaps for us. Lenny Kaye is the longtime guitarist for the Patti Smith Group, and in 1972, he curated the now legendary box set of 60s rock music called Nuggets. Lenny Kaye is in our New York studios. Welcome.
It's great to be here and to celebrate the half century of the English invasion.
So you were a teenager when this happened, right?
I was. I was perfectly positioned to be swept up in the hysteria about a few months before that summer, before I'd learned my first chords on the guitar, hoping to be a lonely folk singer in the backyard. And then all of a sudden, an entire new role model and aspirational ideal came before me on the television.
So even though it's almost inconceivable, there were some bands that should have been part of that invasion that just weren't. Where do you want to start?
Well, for me, one of my favorite British bands that never got over here were The Shadows. They were originally Cliff Richard's backing band. Cliff Richard was kind of referred to as the English Elvis.
The thing about this, I'd never heard this before today. It sounds familiar to me, but it sounds American, like surf guitar, like Dick Dale or The Ventures, something
like
that.
Well, they were very influential. Jorgen Igman had the hit with Apache here, but for me, I love The Shadows because what they did, they were slightly before the English invasion, but they convinced just about everybody in England that they could play guitar. It was definitely a new sound and a real symbol that the electric guitar, which of course was so important to all the British beat groups, was establishing itself as the texture and the instrument of its time.
Okay, I know you want to play us a band called The Big Three, which I'm totally unfamiliar with. Some other guy now has taken all love away from me. Oh, now, some other guy now. What can you tell us about The Big Three?
Well, Liverpool was the center of the early years. A lot of the influences came through the seaport from seamen who had been overseas. And they were one of the oldest groups. They started in 1959. In fact, Brian Kasser from the group was originally in a skiffle band with Bill Wyman from the Rolling Stones.
So you used a term I think a lot of people might not be familiar with, skiffle. What is skiffle?
Skiffle is essentially folk music that was played on guitars, homemade instruments. The Beatles actually were a skiffle band before they took on the Eddie Cochran and Buddy Holly mantle. It was kind of a way in which the British bands could acquaint themselves with American roots and folk roots.
So that guitar sound, that kind of groove, that's skiffle.
That's skiffle. And the drums. In fact, Johnny Hutchinson from the Big Three was the Beatles' first choice to be the drummer before they chose Ringo to replace Pete Best.
I'm speaking with guitarist and archivist Lenny Kaye about some of the best UK bands that missed out on a British invasion.
The next up was a group called the Mercy Beats, who were also from Liverpool and were one of the earliest beat groups that took over the British charts in 1963.
When the night is cold and my arms want someone to hold, I think of you.
That's smooth. That's easy to listen to.
And probably not the best thing for them. Their records are very pop. It didn't really reflect their harder sound. They would later change their names to the Mercies and do a song in 1966 called Sorrow, which is quite a British classic, and David Bowie covered that on his Pinups record.
You're acting fun, spending all my money. You're out there playing your heartless games.
Next up, I think you've got a band that's got close ties to the Rolling Stones, but they didn't make a splash here, though.
I'm a road runner, honey.
Ah, the Pretty Things, the Pretty Things. Phil May was their vocalist, and Dick Taylor, their lead guitarist, actually started out as the bass guitarist for the Rolling Stones when Brian Jones first came up with the name. He went to art college with Mick and Keith. They were really a kind of bedrock R&B band in the style of the Stones. Again, mostly covers, because a lot of these bands started by emulating their American inspirations.
So once again, aside from the accent, that sounds pretty American to me. Was that one of the covers?
Yes, that's one of the covers, Roadrunner. I think the Gans had the hit over here. The Pretty Things are also interesting because they're one of the only groups to make the transition to psychedelia from being a British beat group. Their album SF Sorrow is considered one of the first rock operas. It's kind of trippy, and by 1968, when it came on, it certainly influenced bands like The Who to take on the sense of a concept album.
Some light of his days was spent in the gray of his mind, as he stole love with the tongue of lies. The world is shrank in size.
They never came over here. Probably they didn't start writing original songs till it was too late. But I've always liked them. They're really roughshod, and you can only imagine them trading licks with the Rolling Stones at one time or another.
Lenny, unfortunately, we're about out of time here, which is really unfortunate.
Wait, I have another 700 groups to go.
I bet you do. give us one last one, though.
Well, my favorite of the performers that didn't come over here is a singer named Chris Farlow. He was inspired by Lonnie Donegan, the king of the skiffle, but he didn't sound at all like him. His voice was very black, essentially. In a way, he could have been Rod Stewart.
They call it Starry Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad.
Nice. Thanks for turning us on to all this music.
That's my pleasure. Come over to my house and we can go through my record collection anytime you like.
Well, we're going to do that. That's Patti Smith, guitarist and music obsessive Lenny Kaye. If you'd like to hear full songs from these acts, go to our website, nprmusic.org. If you take a moment to flip through the radio stations here in Los Angeles, past NPR, of course, you'll pass by the pop stations, the politics,
he's the leader of the free world,
jazz. But then you might come upon a voice like no other on the radio.
Well, hi there. This is Art LeBeau checking in here. We'd like you to connect with us and help us pick some music and say hi on the air to one of your friends, or just call in and say, hey, I want to hear this song. And,
Art LeBeau. That signature voice is on the air six nights a week on more than a dozen stations in California and the southwestern U.S. He's 88 years old now, but not slowing down. This week, he'll be hosting his annual series of Valentine's concerts, featuring the oldies but goodies he's played for decades. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has this profile.
Now, I could tell you about all of the accolades and awards Art LeBeau has received. Here's just a couple. A star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, a spot in the National Radio Hall of Fame, but to really understand what Art LeBeau means, you've got to listen to the devotion of his fans, who call in almost every night of the week.
I never talked to you. You're a wonderful man, Art.
Well, thank you.
You have a beautiful, handsome voice. You're in the right field.
You got me blushing. Thanks a lot. Now we'll play your song.
Okay, Art.
Aruba, Jamaica. Ooh, I wanna take. His style may not be flashy. The music is not new. But Art LeBeau has lasted.
I'm on the radio, been on for 70 years.
I met Art LeBeau at his home in the Hollywood Hills. Behind that deep baritone is a small, kind man. He's just over 5 feet tall. And Art LeBeau's story starts in 1925, when he was born Arthur Egnoyan in Salt Lake City, Utah. He says from the moment his family got their first radio, he was hooked.
I was 8 years old. And we plugged it in, and I told my mom, "Mom, the box is talking." And after that, she couldn't tear me away from this radio. I used to sit with my hands on my chin, looking into the grill cloth, imagining somebody at the other end.
By the time he was a teenager, he was on the air himself with a low-watt ham radio.
I'd talk to neighbors, and I'd give them a phone number once in a while, and I'd get a call or two. Now I was really in seventh heaven, you know.
He served in the military during World War II, and his training in the Signal Corps helped him to talk his way into a job in radio. It was a station manager in San Francisco who said he should change his last name from Egnoyan to LeBeau. By the mid-1950s, Art LeBeau was hosting his own show in Los Angeles, just as rock and roll was bursting onto the scene. And Art LeBeau wanted to be part of it.
People are playing the Doris Day, you know, okay, sa-da, sa-da, sa-da. And I'd say, okay, mothers, gather up your daughters. Here comes Art LeBeau and his devil music. Da-da-da-da-da. If you're looking for trouble.
Came to the right place.
Did you really go on the air and say, yeah, here comes Art LeBeau with his devil music?
Yeah, I didn't do it every night, but I did do it.
My daddy was a green-eyed mouth in Jack before I'm
Even early on, LeBeau was an innovator. He would get out of the studio and broadcast live from drive-in restaurants in L.A. People would sit in their cars, windows rolled down, and shout out requests. And that's where LeBeau's career really took off.
He understood that cars and music and teenagers go together, especially in Los Angeles.
That's Josh Kuhn. He's a professor at the University of Southern California, and he says the requests have always been the key to Art LeBeau's appeal.
He's recognized that playing songs on the radio is never just about playing songs on the radio, that playing songs is about building communities, and it's about connecting to the most intimate, most painful, most emotional aspects of people's lives.
Over the decades, LeBeau has worked as a concert promoter. He helped produce new artists. He was one of the first people to sell compilation albums with his Oldies But Goodies series. But in one way or another, LeBeau has stayed on the radio and stayed with his listeners. And with a dedication on his show, people feel like their loved ones, some serving in the military, others even in prison, aren't quite so far away.
Well, hi, Andrea. What city are you calling from?
I'm calling from Riverside.
Okay.
I would like to tell my husband, Daniel, who's in Chino, California right now. Hi, Daddy. I love you, and I miss you, and you know that you're my world, and that you mean everything to me. I'm counting down the days. And
somewhat surprisingly, this 88-year-old Armenian-American has his most ardent following among Latinos. I recently visited El Monte, a city just outside of Los Angeles. That's where a group called the South El Monte Arts Posse has been gathering memories and photos of the city's early rock and roll scene and its connections to Mexican-American life.
If there was really an icon, you know, the word is used so often, an LA icon, he's really the one.
That's Ruben Guevara. He's a 71-year-old musician, and he's played in bands since the early 1960s. He says Art LeBeau has provided the soundtrack to a lot of his life.
Music we fell in love to, you know, got married to, raised kids with. So he became like, you know, a really constant family member.
The group at the event was mostly Latino, a mix of young and old, and people spoke lovingly of Art LeBeau. mostly because every night on the radio, especially in those early days, he listened, without judgment, to a community that did not often get attention from the media. Here's Luis Delgado and Pat Mejia.
Taking messages and names that were familiar, names that were even in Spanish, just knowing that you were being heard.
You could relate to him, or he related to you. You almost felt like you knew him.
A dedication going out to Omar, Victor, Scotty, Blair, Coco, Joe, Maria, Uncle Ricky, and Lion, all from Raul in Fresno, California.
Listening. Like most nights, Art LeBeau will be on the air tonight. He says he has no plans to retire.
It is difficult for me to think of leaving the radio business. I'm still a radio guy, and I have to say this, you know, I think my reality has exceeded my dreams by far.
And he has come a long way, from that boy with a ham radio connecting with an audience just around the block. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Well, we might be dancing, we might be playing love songs, but right here we're going to rock with Cool and the Gang and Get Down on It.
For the week ending February 9th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is technical director, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo de L'Avila. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Phil Harrell is standing in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening. Get on it.